Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we've got wine again this evening. We had been doing our last couple episodes on weekdays, therefore on school nights I don't drink too much. But now we're recording this on a Friday evening. What are we looking at here?
We are looking at a Cabernet Sauvignon called Irony.
Now, I'm not going to say this connects to any particular film, but once we get into our discussions, you'll understand why I got a bottle called Irony. So we're going to circle back to why we have this bottle.
Looking forward to that one.
All right. Well, it's this weekend before Christmas. Christmas time is a very big movie time. Everybody at least goes to one movie because you either go to your family's house, your family comes to your house, and after about 24 hours, you're tired of staring at one another. So you're like, let's get out of the house. We're going to go to the movies. And you have a lot of choices this week. And we're not even going to discuss the ones that open Christmas Day.
Right. We'll save that for
next week. Because there are plenty to talk about on this episode, including a new superhero movie. Not Marvel. We're talking DC. A Disney remake sequel. And another Transformers. And there's a Netflix offering. And you saw
a
rom-com.
A chick flick.
So we've got a lot to talk about. And I want to start off with the film that's most likely going to win the weekend, which is the superhero movie, Aquaman. Aquaman is a character that gets made fun of a lot in the comic books. Remember on Entourage, Vinny Chase played Aquaman because it's kind of always considered the unfilmable superhero movie.
Right. He wanted to play the Pablo Escobar, but he had to do Aquaman first.
And Aquaman, so we saw him in Justice League. We've seen him before and briefly underwater. But now we get some underwater Jason Momoa with his shirt off. And there's a lot of plot in Aquaman. It's very long.
There's
it's a very long movie.
Too much plot in Aquaman.
He doesn't want anything to do with the underwater world. He's like a demigod. Like his dad is a regular mortal, regular old guy. Keeps a lighthouse in Maine, salt of the earth. His mom is Queen of Atlantis, Nicole Kidman. Queen Atlanta. She runs away from an arranged marriage she wants nothing to do with, falls in love with Joe Public, and they have Arthur. They have Arthur Curry, aka Aquaman. And he grows up without a mom because mom has to go back. Her old life catches up with her. Nicole Kidman disappears, and he grows up kind of resenting the underwater world for what they did. They took his mom away. So he doesn't want to go down there, but he gets drugged down there by Princess Mara, Amber Heard, drags him back. He's like, I don't care if you don't want to come down here. We need you. So there's a quest about finding a mythical trident. There's family conflict with his half-brother, King Orm, played by Patrick Wilson.
Gotta love Patrick Wilson.
There's the threat of war between the subsurface and the terrestrial. There is King Orm has to defeat all the other fish kingdoms before he can even attack the surface. There's so much going on.
And then there's like a whole other villain type person.
Oh, I didn't even get to Black Manta.
So it was for an origin story. I think they tried to do too much because I appreciated getting Aquaman's backstory. It's kind of like a Superman kind of story. You know, it's like, oh, here, this woman just washes ashore, falls in love, there's a kid that's born, a parent disappears, and then, you know, starts discovering his abilities, and Willem Dafoe plays this guy sort of like a mentor to him to teach him the ways of the seas. And I liked knowing and understanding the basics of this character because we already saw him in the Justice League movie. But he's already sort of fully formed in his character, and now we're kind of taking a step back, and you're kind of seeing how this Aquaman guy became Aquaman.
Aquaman is directed by James Wan. He cut his teeth. He started with low-budget horror. He made the first and best, by far, out of nowhere, Saw movie, the one that just shocked the world and became a cult classic. I remember I saw it because people just kept talking about, have you seen Saw? Have you seen Saw?
Well, oh my God. And The Conjuring, which I loved.
He created the Conjuring franchise. He directed The Conjuring and The Conjuring mm-hmm. 2, Insidious 2, all starring Patrick Wilson,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, which is why Patrick Wilson shows up in Aquaman.
And then he got money. He got money to film Furious 7. Which was a challenge because that's where Paul Walker died.
Right.
And he pulled it off. It
he
was
did. It was good.
And that's where he learned to be insane. James Wan, I think, at times in Aquaman, he wants you to laugh. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he wants you to laugh along with it or he wants you to laugh at it. Because there's an octopus playing the drums. There is lobster men. There is this really, really big creature voiced by Julie Andrews. By the way, did you know?
No, I didn't
notice that until afterward. That thing at the end, that's Julie Andrews.
Oh, wow.
And I think maybe that's why she's not in Mary Poppins Returns. when we meet him a lot and he just smiles at the camera, I hear power chords on a guitar and he smirks. He's like, ha ha. Like, you're in on the joke with me. This is a joke.
Well, but that's where you can't really figure out where this film wants to land. Like, it's all at once. In some moments, it's serious and then it's cheesy dialogue and then it's downright campy, but then it gets back to sort of a serious theme. And so Marvel does, they walk that line so much better than the DC franchise does, because you know, we've seen so many really dark Supermans and Batmans, and you know, and so I appreciated that Aquaman was seeking to be a lighter film, but I just wish that they had picked a voice and kind of stuck with it. And there was absolutely no reason for this movie to be over 2 hours. It was definitely bloated and they should have stripped at least one of the subplots out of it.
Yeah, there's way too much going on here. It's way too long. And the dialogue is actually atrocious. I mean, the standard fare is, it's a myth. It's not a myth. And when Aquaman's talking to us in voiceover at the beginning, he says, I was the product of love that should have never been. I don't even think that's grammatically correct.
The exposition was a little over the top in some of these places. I'll tell you what I did think, though, is Nicole Kidman looks phenomenal in the aging. They do the
age thing because Willem Dafoe got it, too.
Yeah, but with Nicole Kidman, you could just as easily be watching Nicole Kidman from 25 years ago. She looks really good. The guy who's playing her husband, the age progression and regression for him is not nearly as seamless. But we've seen Nicole Kidman now in Boy Erased and in Destroyer. She's showing some pretty major versatility. She's not in this film all that much, but when she is, she kind of commands the screen, I think.
Did you know? So one thing that really got under my skin is when they're talking underwater. And I know doing underwater effects is very hard. Apparently, they were on a soundstage and they always had to be wet to get that look being underwater. But when it also sounds different when they're talking underwater. And I found it very hard at points to hear them.
Yes. No, I did too. I wasn't sure if it was just
they're making it echoey and it's bassy. And I really can't hear them a lot.
Yeah. It's a little bit of thing going on. But some of those scenes underwater are pretty spectacular looking. And when I talk about the inconsistencies in this film, you go from really amazing looking shots to then these things that look like they suddenly take you into what feels more like a video game look and feel. And so, to me, the characters sometimes almost look like they turned into avatars, and it was distracting.
It's a very CGI-heavy film, and just a caveat, we did not see this on IMAX mm-hmm. or in 3D, which mm-hmm. is maybe how you're supposed to see it.
I think so.
We saw this in 2D on a standard multiplex screen, so maybe we were limited with certain colors and vivacity. I don't know.
I suspect as much, because I have friends who saw it on 3D or maybe an IMAX, and they definitely got a lot more out of it. And so I think if you are interested in seeing this one, I suspect it's worth going. This is one where it definitely is worth seeing it as it's meant to be seen on a very big screen at least in either IMAX or 3D.
There's an environmental message about the people under the sea getting really mad at everything we dump into it. There's an appalling cover by Pitbull of Toto's Africa, which I can't stop listening to because it's so... oh my lord, it is amazingly...
But it was kind of funny.
I just can't believe it.
But that was a fun... That was one of those moments that you just kind of poked fun at. So whether or not it was going... I think it was going for that. I think it was meant to grate on you.
And my favorite tweet I've seen about this so far is, Jesus turned water into wine, but he never turned wine into wine knives.
Oh, well, and wasn't your, was it, did you retweet something about how Jason Momoa's wife, Lisa Bonet, is the same age as Nicole Kidman, who's playing his mother
in this film? No, because I didn't know Jason Momoa was married to Lisa Bonet.
I think that's what I had seen, so it wasn't I'm going to have to check on that. Yeah, I saw some tweet and I was like, okay, that's kind of fascinating.
Because he's, I don't know how old he is in real life. I think I might be older than him.
But
this is just a strange film. And now I'm not urging anyone to run out and see this. I'm not panning it either. It's not terrible, but it's so nuts.
No, it just tries too hard to be too many things, but... If you are a fan of that superhero genre and you're going to watch the Justice League movies and you've seen all the others, this is just another one of those ones that you're going to go see regardless of what any of us have to say about it, because you're still going to get something out of it. And so it's not terrible, and that makes it worthwhile enough to see if that's part of your fan universe is both either the DC comic universe and or the Marvel comics, because next time you see him alongside Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, you know, I think you're going to appreciate Jason Momoa's character a little bit more.
Speaking of movies people are going to go see regardless of what we say, Mary Poppins Returns. It's been since 1964 since the first movie came out. It took him this long to make a sequel, and that's because... P.L. Travers actually wrote it into her will that they could not make a sequel, and finally her estate kind of turned that over and said, go ahead. They tangentially touched on it with 2013's Saving Mr. Banks, which actually kind of made it P.L. Travers' fault about certain things about Mary Poppins, and which is a shame, because Mary Poppins is near and dear to her heart. She created this serious, stern nanny out of very autobiographical circumstances, and Disney fight it with songs and penguins. And no, she was not very happy about it. But it's too late. The genie's out of the bottle. People grew up with Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins became a beloved figure in many households, and a lot of times it's people's first movie, and it's on over and over again, and they just know they grow up with Mary Poppins. Julie Andrews. Mary Poppins. Now we have Emily Blunt, Mary Poppins. So Hannah, how is the new Mary Poppins Returns the same yet different than the original?
Well, it's different in that you won't remember any of the songs from the new version of Mary Poppins, whereas there are songs and earworms that have stuck with me for decades. And I could not remember a single tune 2 weeks after seeing the screening of Mary Poppins Returns. Emily Blunt, however, is spot on. She is perfect casting as Mary Poppins. And so that part of it, she can sing. She has just the right sarcastic kind of vibe going. And she, I think, is the best choice they ever could have made and found for this character, and one that could conceivably carry the franchise further. Like, I could see an all new story. Like, it's too much the same, because in Mary Poppins Returns, we are essentially seeing a redo of the first one, except that the Banks children are now grown up and the children of Michael Banks now need some looking after, and the family needs some help to come together, and the house on Cherry Tree Lane is in danger of being foreclosed by an evil banker dude played by Colin Firth. And so, you sort of feel like you're watching a lot of the same beats. Lin-Manuel Miranda steps in, is where Dick Van Dyke played a chimney sweep friend of Mary Poppins. Now you have Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame coming in and playing a street lamplighter who is a pal to Mary. And Lin-Manuel Miranda's character, I felt, could have been pretty much played by any bloke with talent who can sing. I think he was underutilized in this film. And so it's a tough one because I do think a lot of people are really looking forward to seeing it. A lot of people at the screening that I was at did absolutely enjoy it. But I felt that it was missing the songs and the feeling of joy that the original had. Wasn't feeling that with this one.
I mostly agree with you. It is more remake than sequel. Everything just kind of perfectly aligns. The songs are not there. I've been listening to the soundtrack, and it didn't get any better at all. You don't remember anything. There are no central set pieces. Nothing here will be nominated for best song.
No Spoonful of Sugar, no Chim Chim Tree.
None of it. And the original was kind of this love letter to London. It had this majesty. It had this feed the birds while I'm looking at London, this majesty. There's none of that here. Where we disagree is you said Lin-Manuel Miranda was underutilized. I disagree. I think he actually had more screen time than Mary Poppins. It almost seems like at times Mary Poppins was a supporting character. The Learys, specifically him, he gets more. He has a lot to do. He's there on most of the adventures. Remember in the original one, Ed Wynn was laughing so hard he went onto the ceiling. And that was actually kind of a throwaway moment from the original film. Now they took that again and they made it a central set piece with Meryl Streep, whose whole, I don't know, house goes upside down now. And they sing the worst song in the film called Turning Turtle. Lin-Manuel's in that one. He sings this central song, which is Trip the Light Fantastic. That's the biggest song in the film, I think. Or if you want to say the one that go into the porcelain bowl for the animated part, he gets most of that song too. He has more presence than she does.
But because those songs aren't memorable, maybe that's why I didn't remember him being in that many scenes, because the music just didn't stick with me. And to me, he was always just kind of more on the periphery, you know, popping in and out. But I do think the colors, it's a very colorful film. It kept the kids engaged from what I could see. It is very fantastical still. The idea of, you know, these kids who've had it rough for a year, they've lost their mom and things are just, it's just been a tough time. And Mary Poppins, you know, comes down on her with her traditional umbrella and floats down from the sky and really brings sort of just some life back into the house and lets the children be children and just shows them all this fantasy, fantastical stuff. So for that, it was, I think, a decent family-friendly escapist movie. I'm just personally, because I'm such a movie musical fan, the lack of powerful, memorable songs is a huge disappointment to not have that in this sequel. But Emily Blunt, I can totally see her and Lin-Manuel Miranda being given a completely fresh Mary Poppins story. You know, bring in some fresh kids that she, you know, make it more like when the show The Super Nanny, you know, let her go and make it a series of stories where she can actually go and help other children now and move the narrative away from being a repeat of the 1964 version.
Well, P.L. Travers did write 8 different Mary Poppins books. There's far more territory to explore. Did you notice a change in the demeanor of Mary Poppins? In the first one, remember that the children cause a run on the bank, and George Banks comes home, and he's very cross, and he's like, Mary Poppins, how could you let this happen? How could you do this to me? And she's, I never explain anything. She gives him a lot of guff. She throws things back in George Banks' face. But in this one, the children once again cause a scene in the bank, and Michael doesn't like all their adventures, and they're causing a ruckus, and he snaps at her. He snaps at Mary Poppins, and she says, yes, sir. Sorry, sir. I'll clean up now, sir. And the original Mary Poppins never would have done that. And that, there's a shift. There's a shift. And also Jane Banks, who, remember, in the original, it was Votes for Women. Mom was an absent mom because she was a suffragette. votes for always getting arrested. Now Jane is pro-union. She's, I don't remember. It's a very long acronym for underpaid workers. And the theme is that she's single, she lives alone, but she would be much happier and better off with a man, specifically Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I just did not see the chemistry between those two at all.
There wasn't any to be explored in the future.
I did not like the change in Mary Poppins. She's meeker now. She acquiesces to the authority.
Oh, see, I don't believe that. I believe you are led to believe that that's the front she's putting on. But that's where I think Emily Blunt captures it so perfectly, is that you know that she's playing them. And so I think she's playing them, and you got played at the same time. I don't see that at all. So I absolutely felt that she knew exactly what she was doing, and she was being very effective. And I just thought she was spot on,
practically perfect in
every way.
Well, the vanity is still there. She still stares at herself in mirrors and
to be honest, it's been so many years since I saw the original one that I did not really truly remember. I had very little memory of the actual story, so all that had stayed with me all these years were the songs. So if there was all the parallels and things didn't bother me as much as they did, you know, with someone who maybe had seen the original Mary Poppins more recently.
Well, they picked a tried and true director, Rob Marshall. He was nominated for Best Director for Chicago. He made Into the Woods. The man knows his way around a musical.
Yes.
But I'm not sure he knows his way around a very good musical.
Well, and I'm not sure.
Into the Woods wasn't that great either.
But I don't think he was given the right material for this.
No, he doesn't write his own scripts or his own songs. He just makes the film. You know,
I think it was made probably as well as it could be with that material. That's why I kind of am willing to give them all another shot, but sort of, you know, just come up with a better story for them in this age. Although it was still taking you back to, you know, it's taking place, what, like 30 years later than the original was supposed to, you know, was. And so it was still London, year that was.
So the first film was 1910. This one's in the 30s.
Yeah. So you're still placing everything in 1930s London. And so I think it would be kind of interesting to see Mary Poppins perhaps pop in a different time period. I just think that with Emily Blunt and potentially Lin-Manuel Miranda, that there's something better to be found here. And I hope that you know, if it does end up doing well, that somebody comes up with a better third story.
All right. Well, Hannah, I am shocked that on the same weekend Aquaman is opening and around Christmas and another major movie like Mary Poppins, Bumblebee, another Transformers film, specifically the sixth film and a prequel at that and a spinoff, is opening the same weekend. Bumblebee and Aquaman should not be opening on the same weekend.
They should
not. It doesn't work. However, this is why I want to talk about my wine called Irony. Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, a rom-com, some other stuff we're going to talk about. Bumblebee is the week's best film. And I want to tell you why. I am not a Transformers acolyte. I didn't watch them growing up. Yeah. And I am not a Transformers franchise apologist. I haven't liked any of the films to date. The first five, starting in 2007 until the one I didn't even see last year, because I was so tired of the Michael Bay over-directed, over-produced sensory onslaught garbage that was Transformers. And then I saw Bumblebee. And it's not about the Transformers. It's about a girl and her VW bug. And that first moment where she's under the car, she still thinks it's a Volkswagen Beetle, and she's trying to get it to run, and just the lights turn on, it's baby blue eyes, and it transforms right above her into this kind of childlike, scared robot.
Giant robot.
There's some empathy in this film. Mm-hmm. There's some feelings in here. And it's not, yes, there's action. John Cena's in it, and robots still slice and dice one another. But that's the minority. The majority is Hailee Steinfeld. Oscar-nominated Hailee Steinfeld, remember her from True Grit, and now from the Pitch Perfect franchise, and Bumblebee, and it's cute, and I liked it, and it's like a Steven Spielberg coming-of-age film. She's missing a parent, dad died, and it's not that Bumblebee becomes this father figure, surrogate father, he just helps her cope with the world. She's not functioning very well at home. She's not functioning very well with her peers. There's an awkward boy next door who likes her but can't quite get up the nerve to talk to her. And Bumblebee just turns out he helps her. She helps him. Bumblebee is just a delight.
He's a friend. He becomes a friend to her. Bumblebee, I went out of my way this morning to go to a 9:30 a.m. screening of this movie. I was all alone in the theater, so I certainly had a really nice view and a very wonderful atmosphere. But I felt that I had to go see this because so many people were talking about it, and it has like a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes.
No Transformers film has ever received an overall fresh tomato.
And so I was never a huge Transformers person. I think I've seen maybe two of them randomly over the years, just enough to kind of know Optimus Prime and Decepticons and a little bit of the language relating to the Transformers themselves. But I think what makes Bumblebee work is to have an actress of Hailee Steinfeld's caliber playing against these robot creatures, and most notably the Bumblebee character. I think that's what makes this film work. And I hope that my fear is that Bumblebee will get lost in the mix, much the same way that Hailee Steinfeld's really good film, The Edge of 17, got lost. And that she was great in that film, and she's really good in this one. And it's just a shame sometimes that some of these movies that are much better than anyone would expect. I mean, right now the problem is people go, I don't like Transformer movies, or I'm not into those, or you see a trailer and you just see these giant robots fighting each other. But what this movie really is, I mean, it starts with the big fight scenes and a lot of explosions. It's very loud. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I don't know. But then it shifts and you're suddenly, you know, on Earth with Haley's character, and you're building that empathy for the Bumblebee character, and it changes into more of an E.T. kind of movie. And so to me, this is very much like an E.T. wrapped in a Transformers movie, and with an awesome, awesome 80s soundtrack.
I have to remind myself that Hailee Steinfeld is acting against thin air, or sometimes just a tape mark on the wall. Bumblebee's not there. And I don't even think there's a guy in a cardboard suit acting against her. She's acting against thin air, and she does such a good job. Yeah. And so the Transformers, they're from the mid to late 80s. The original generation that fell in love with the Transformers fell in love with them in 1987. This movie takes place in 1987. And I'm not saying it works so well because they took it back in time and threw some nostalgia at us, but it's great that the montage when she's fixing up the Beetle is to Bon Jovi's Runaway. There's some Duran Duran in there. There's You've Got the Touch, You've Got the Power. I mean, there's some there's some wonderful songs in this film. And there's a lot of 80s, like there's Mr. T cereal.
Yes,
on the and she works at a hot dog on a stick. And yeah, there's a lot of 80s going on to it. But I think it that helps it. But it really works because of her performance, mm-hmm. and just the back and forth between the two. You really like their relationship.
You do. You do. You're rooting for both of them. And they're sort of the throwaway characters. The John Cena is that military guy that's in every movie out to, like, you know, we need to destroy all these alien robots, no matter, they've all got to be bad. And, you know, that's going to have to turn. You've got the kid brother who's a nuisance until he's needed to help out. You have the mom and her, you know, either new husband or live-in boyfriend, I'm not sure, you know, and them trying to hold this family together. And you've got the sort of weird kind of the cute guy and the mean girls that are just, I guess, there to show that she's not quite fitting in and that she's going to show them all up. And then you've got the neighbor guy who's always, that character just always appears, the one who's got like the crush on her character, even though she doesn't even, for the first, you know, few minutes of the film, has no idea he's alive and totally ignores him. And then he's that one that the kind of is in on what's going on and helps her out, and they become good buds. That to me was a pretty formulaic kind of character going on. But I absolutely, because 1987, I was pretty darn close to the age that her character is in this film in 1987. So I could relate to a lot of the stuff. And I just loved the way they incorporated the music and the musical choices into the story. And it fits so well and is so entertaining. It is very ironic. I give you that.
It's not supposed to be. It shouldn't work. It's not supposed to. The sixth film in a franchise isn't supposed to be, A, the best one, and B, better than Mary Poppins.
Yeah, and better than Aquaman.
It is.
I mean, and I do feel bad Aquaman and Bumblebee are out at the same time.
Oh, Bumblebee's going to lose. Yeah.
Yeah, it will lose, and it's just a shame because it deserved. The thing with Bumblebee that's so unique is that it really, even if you don't like or you think you don't like those Transformer movies and you have no idea about the Transformer franchise, you can actually go into this one without having seen any of the other Transformer films.
It's almost preferable.
It's almost preferable because they give you – it's an origin story. It's Bumblebee's origin story. And so if you've got the older kids that are looking for an action film and you want the whole family to go to some movie together and you are not a superhero fan, then this is actually, I think, a really solid choice because there is something in there for the adults. And certainly if you're a child of the 80s or 90s, this is really going to be a pleasant surprise.
Well, I was younger than Haley Steinfeld's younger brother in 1987 from this
of
movie.
Of course you were.
But did you see what they did with the director, Travis Knight? He's from Leica Studios. He directed Kubo and the Two Strings. He's a stop-motion animation guy. He was the lead animator on Coraline, on Paranorman, and The Box Trolls. Mm-hmm. I love The Box Trolls. And he was nominated for Best Animated Feature for Kubo and the Two Strings, a wonderful animated film. And I wonder if he brought some of his patience and some of his, you know, movies, you know, don't usually take as long as stop motion does, but, you know, just step back and think about the story first before you just have robots start killing each other.
Yes, but I will point out that I looked it up in this, the screenplay and the story are by a woman. And I think you see that. I think that is probably part of the reason for the softer touch that you actually have in this, you know, very action-packed movie. I think that's where a lot of the heart probably comes from, and the humor.
Speaking of softer touch, after, you know, Aquaman and after Bumblebee, there's already counter-programming this weekend with Mary Poppins Returns. But if you can't stomach that Disney version, I didn't go see it. You're going to go solo on this one. There looks to be a classic Jennifer Lopez romantic comedy also coming out this weekend. So can people escape to that if they can't handle the other stuff?
I don't see why anyone should escape to second act as opposed to Bumblebee. I really don't. Or Mary Poppins. It's very predictable and formulaic. I don't even like that it's called a romantic comedy because the trailer bills it as one because Milo Ventimiglia, who right now is Mr. Hot Stuff from watching This Is Us.
Creed 2.
No, yeah, not from Creed 2. You just spoiled Creed 2
for
people.
No, everybody already knows about that.
But Milo, you know, as Jack on This Is Us, you're just like already in love with this guy, and you just know that he's not playing against type either. But he really is not in this film all that much. He's really just used to help establish the fact that that Jennifer Lopez's character is her name's Maya, and she's turning 40, and she...
Jennifer Lopez is turning 40?
Yeah, I think...
You're about 10 years off on that one.
Her character is turning 40 and is sort of struggling with where she's at in life and whether to start a family with Milo. and he's such a nice guy, and everybody's like, you've found a winner here. But she's resistant because she's still trying to get her professional life in gear. And she's been through some hard times, and you discover that she doesn't have a college degree. And so she's been toiling away as assistant manager at this at some store that she's really good at her job, and she's expecting to get this promotion. But the company brings in, you know, some guy that doesn't really understand the inner workings of the store. And it's like, I swear, you feel like you're at a like you're watching the TV show Superstore. And they're all in the same outfits and having their little company meetings. And so it just was very formulaic, very predictable, very contrived. It's a fine but forgettable sort of standard dramedy. So the reason I say I go with dramedy and, you know, romantic, not so much a romantic comedy or romantic drama, because the story really shifts more towards Maya's efforts to get into, to be able to show that street smarts are just as important as book smarts. It can get you ahead. And she ends up sort of in this competition with this other woman played by Vanessa Hudgens to create a skincare product that's cost effective and greener. And she's got the best friend played by Leah Remini, who is like every other best friend, spunky best friend that you get in all these other similar kind of dramas or comedies. And it's so similar to the general premise of things like Made in Manhattan, and she does the one, The Wedding Planner, where there's always some lie that's going to eventually blow up. And you just, the whole movie is about waiting for the truth to come out and how it's going to be handled. And so this is just not, it's not on par with a Made in Manhattan or with a Wedding Planner. And it absolutely made me think of Working Girl. And then I saw today that it's the 30th anniversary of the Working Girl movie with Melanie Griffith, which is a chick flick classic.
I love that movie.
It is an awesome movie. And so this is like a really weak attempted imitation of sorts of Working Girl. And so all it made me really want to do was run out and see Working Girl again. And that's what I would suggest, is that if you're sort of tempted to see Second Act over any of these other films, I would say hold off, rent Working Girl, or definitely wait for Second Act for a plane. It's a fine time killer on an airplane, or if it hits as a rental, it's going to be an okay choice. But it's pretty darn weak as far as these types of comedies go, and it's very contrived. And there's a twist that I saw coming from a mile away, and so that was just, it was just a little too formulaic and too predictable, and didn't have enough Milo in it to really make it a romantic comedy.
Well, I saw a film this week with America's true sweetheart, Sandra Bullock, and it's called Bird Box. And it's opening in just a handful of theaters, but you can go watch it right now if you have Netflix streaming. You don't have to, you know, pay $17 to go to some matinee or whatever. You can go turn on Bird Box right now. And it's two halves. On one half is present day. Sandra Bullock is, the apocalypse has happened. And she is shepherding two kids on this very dangerous journey, trying to find safe harbor. And they're going down this river, and things are bad. And to cap it off, they can't see. They have to wear blindfolds. They cannot look outside. Otherwise, they will die. In fact, they will kill themselves. Flashback 5 years ago, and we see it kick off. Whatever it is, we never learn what it is, but one day, the world just kills itself. People who look outside, out a window, even in any happenstance, they just throw themselves out of a window or shoot themselves in the head. And we are with this hardy crew of like 10 survivors in a house. Sandra Bullock, John Malkovich, Jackie Weaver, Trevante Rhodes, the guy from Moonlight.
Oh, right.
He was the older one. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful, great, strong cast. Tom Hollander. And then, you know, little by little, they start disappearing. And then, you know, and it keeps flashing forward, flashing back, flashing forward, flashing back. And what's going to hurt Bird Box the most is people saying, well, I already saw this movie earlier this year. It's called A Quiet Place. In A Quiet Place, John Krasinski, Emily Blunt, mm-hmm. They couldn't make a sound. They could see all they want. They could go out in the day. They could go out in the night. They just couldn't make a sound. Otherwise, aliens would come out of the woods and kill them. Here, you can go outside, but why? You're just going to hurt yourself. You can't see. So most people live inside with the the blinds drawn, and it's really hard to function in life if you need to get food, but you can't look where you're going. So it's witty at times. It's frustrating. It's not as good as A Quiet Place. It's really not. The performances are amazing. Sandra Bullock is good. I think this is her first horror movie, by the way. The two kids, you know, it's rough. She's got these two little kids. I mean, tiny kids. And there's a reason for that. It's a tough watch at times. It's just a tad over 2 hours. I wonder if it's just on the tad of too long. I really like the stuff with John Malkovich in it. But I say take the time to watch Bird Box. But if you've already seen A Quiet Place. If you haven't, yeah, what's wrong with you? Go see A Quiet Place.
Because A Quiet Place was shockingly good. Like, I generally don't particularly care for that genre, but Emily Blunt and John Krasinski really stunned me with putting together just a very gripping
Emily
drama.
Blunt was my best supporting actress of the year
I did. I actually put her, I think I put her near the top as well.
I think also John Krasinski was one of my best directors.
And the deaf girl in it, I put her for the child actress.
Millicent Simmons. But yeah, Bird Box, it's not fair. One of our WAFCA buddies, Rocky Hadidi, tweeted, you know, it's just because two movies of the same type are out at the same time doesn't mean one of them's bad. Maybe they both can be good.
Yeah.
And, you know, they both weren't good, but you remember Deep Impact and Armageddon were released like back to back, or Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Both of those. Yeah.
You know,
it does happen,
but it's not Bird Box's fault that Quiet Place came out just a couple months ago and was better. It's a fine film. And in fact, if there was no Quiet Place, people probably would be losing their minds over Bird Box right now.
Well, and I think that happens with almost all of these films. And with the people who really like the things that we think are kind of weak, very often it's because they haven't seen anything like it, and we have. And so we're sort of making these, you know, comparisons in our heads that other people wouldn't be making because they're only getting to see, you know, 1/50th of the films that we are cramming in at any given time. So I do understand that. And to me, Sandra Bullock is, you know, I just love her in the rom-coms and the romantic dramas and the While You Were Sleeping, which I could see 1,000 times over and over again. And so I'm looking at second act thinking, oh man, those Sandra Bullock romantic comedies and romantic dramas and the earlier ones that Jennifer Lopez has done is so much better. Something like Bird Box just did not have, there's just nothing that would particularly appeal to me about it, and I don't have Netflix.
No, I'm not going to urge you to rush out and see this because I agree. Quiet Place is better. You already saw the better one. What tickles me pink on this episode is that you saw the Korean film. You saw the Korean film, and this is usually me. This is my point. I saw a foreign film, and you saw it. So tell us about...
I am so mad that you did not see this
I told
film.
You I wasn't going to watch it.
You're the one who
I said
you forwarded me...
Because it looks like your movie.
It wasn't, and I kept telling you it's a Charlie movie.
So what are we talking about here?
So we're talking about this film called Swing Kids, not to be confused
which I saw
like,
in 1993.
It is not the 1993 movie with like Christian Bale and, you know, and... Robert Sean Leonard and Kenneth Branagh were in. It's not that at all. It is this weird musical drama that's set during the Korean War, and you have these soldiers at a POW camp that take up like tap dancing and stuff in order to distract themselves from all the craziness that's going on. And the prisoners, one of the prisoners takes part. And it's sort of this band of misfits get together and form this troupe in an attempt to kind of get out of the misery of their existence. It's a very satirical kind of movie. It's the synopsis and the trailer do not prepare you at all for what you're actually going to get. It's very misleading. It's not what I expected at all. It is what I would consider the most, if you took a mashup of a Charlie film and a Hannah film, this is what you would get. And you so have to see it because it was a Charlie movie and it was in Korean with English subtitles. And it has this really bizarre dance-off with the soldiers, and it takes this really crazy, brutal turn that had Charlie written all over it. And I'm just so mad that you did not see it, because I would never have gotten this one. This was strictly from one of your weird...
Because judging, you know, I watched the trailer on this one just to check it out, and you have to agree with me, from the trailer, this looks like your movie.
But I thought it looked like your movie just as much.
And I had never had any intention of watching this
thing.
But
you did not make that clear when you sent it to me, and so I'm still annoyed that you did not watch it, because it is a Charlie movie entirely. It is a Korean foreign film that has...
Yes, a Korean foreign film is my best film of the year. It's called Burning.
That takes a bizarre, bloody turn that just would have...
So does Burning.
That would have just pleased you to no end and left me going, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm watching this one and you're not. And
I think you're the stronger person for it. You're stronger now.
I think you owe me one big time.
What?
Because this was all you, and you're the one who's always pushing seeing these Korean films. And I stuck with it. I mean, it wasn't bad. It's not a bad film.
I told you, you're better for it.
It's just, it was just not what I was expecting. And it was a total... You loved like the Stalin film earlier this year. This movie is for you. So I think at some point you should see it.
All right, wrap up on this longer pre-Christmas episode of all over the place films. Aquaman, newest superhero movie out there. It is insane. There's too much going on, but it kind of wants you to laugh at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth seeing for that origin story, and Jason Momoa is fun to watch, but it's on the weaker side of the superhero films.
Mary Poppins Returns is not a sequel. They remade the first one. Everything's the same. It's the same arc. It's the same everything.
But not the same music, and that's a problem.
A lot of people, I think, are going to be disappointed in this.
Yeah, and it's Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda. I think that gives it a freshness, but they need to find better music and more memorable music.
And the biggest ironic twist of the entire year, Bumblebee is the week's best film out of all of these, because the connection between Haley Steinfeld and the car robot thing is awesome.
It's the best film if you want an action. It's still very much an action movie. You have to like those to some degree. It's not something that people who have never seen who have no sense of a Transformer movie at all, or have never, don't really care to for the alien sci-fi type movies. It's got heart, it's got humor, it's really good, but I still think you have to be okay with sort of the high adrenaline action stuff that is a big part of it, that is better because it's got the heart too.
And second act?
Second act, I think you can take a pass on this one and just, I'm telling you, go celebrate the 30th anniversary of Working Girl and download the Carly Simon song, Let the River Run, and you'll be happy.
Bird Box is the best film released on Netflix today. And no, it's good for if you need your Sandra Bullock fix or your dystopian apocalypse fix. There's some crazy twists and surprises going on in there.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where I'm not sorry to not have Netflix. There are some where I would be sorry to miss something that's just on Netflix, but this doesn't sound like my cup of tea.
And your favorite, Swing Kids.
And Swing Kids is the Charlie movie that Charlie failed to see, and I think it's opening in maybe a dozen theaters around the country total, so chances are you won't find it or see it anywhere. But if you happen to spot it and you are just in the mood for something that's really bizarre, then this would be the pick of the week for that.
All right. Well, I can dig it. Well, Merry Christmas. Not quite Happy New Year, because we're going to have another episode between then and now. So on behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah. is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.